Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 18th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Geology, a Key to Northwest Beauty, Session 1 of Humans in the Natural Environment, presented by Rose McKerney, number MCR 2003-01. Let's listen in.
Our environment, and I have a couple of reasons for starting with sort of an overview of the geology of the state of Washington. And the first reason is that as an undergraduate, I had an upper division geology class, like junior level, and we were supposed to tell on a test why you would use stone for building, and we all talked about strength and durability. And the professor came back after the test and said, but we use it because it's beautiful, and no one said anything about it. So this is a slight dedication to a professor who has since passed away, because I won't ever forget that, and so I started with it this time. And then another reason for this is actually more in keeping with the session as a whole about humans and our environment. And it's about the Pacific Northwest, and I realize that many of you may not be from the Pacific Northwest, but we sort of have an image throughout the country of a place of being very environmentally aware, a very beautiful place, which I would agree with. And these are some words from the book called Natural Grace by William Dietrich, who writes for the Seattle Times, or the PI, or whatever its current name is. During our short recorded history, what has been made the Pacific Northwest distinctive is mountain and sound, tree and trail, river and range. Yet this Pacific Northwest is increasingly a place most of us have to drive miles to find. Time pressures add anxiety. Okay, and then he goes on to say, I was born and raised in Washington State and have watched its population more than double in my lifetime. Like many Northwest natives, I've grumped with dismay about the disappearance of old-growth forests, the collapse of salmon runs, the clogging of highways, the crowding of campgrounds, and the escalation of housing prices. Yet when I was a Tacoma kid, I knew little about the landscape where I fished, hunted, and hiked. It was green and pretty, and I was all for the environment with a capital E. But it was something to be crossed instead of inhabited, a weekend destination instead of home. I hardly knew and didn't care which tree was which or what kinds of lives animals might lead. And so part of this is the beginning of understanding the place, and the importance of understanding place from my point of view is that when we understand the place we live in, we start to care for it more. So I'm trying to bring the sort of pristine setting that we're currently inhabiting, and how much of that can we take home, and what can we build from there? So that's my overall goal for the week. But today is just sort of the taste of what's geology under our feet across the state like. So it's going to be a pretty broad brush, and not the detailed geology of Holden. And then, don't you dare do that to me. What happened is the computer went to sleep because I was taking too long. So actually, what I wanted to know is, what is it that actually builds our landscape? What are the processes that build the landscape around us? And I've sort of given it away, part of it. But what sorts of processes do you know about that form the environment that we inhabit from a geologic point of view?
Movement of the surface of the earth.
Movement of the surface of the earth is what actually builds mountains. Is there anything else that builds?
Volcanoes
and earthquakes are actually a part of that moving of the plate, and but they're pretty important from our point of view. Anything else? The weather. What does the weather do?
Like ice.
Mm-hmm. Water.
Ice and water. So we're going to be looking at sort of a balance between the plates shifting and the weather. And that's what actually builds the surface around us. And so the plates actually shift on the surface of the Earth because the center of the Earth is really, really, really hot. It's a hot, solid, core of iron in the middle. And because the center is so hot, the Earth is always, just like a pot of water on the stove, trying to give off heat. And if you've ever watched water boil, it actually moves in what we call convection currents. The hot material rises, and the cold material sinks. And the same thing is happening on the surface of the Earth. The time scale is a bit longer. takes a while for those little cells to move all the way around. But as those cells move around, the solid, rigid outer layer of the Earth, which actually has what we call the tectonic plates on it, gets dragged with it. So we're actually victims of passive movement of the outer surface of the Earth when we talk about this. And so it's just the Earth is trying to give off heat all the time. And if we look at the world as a whole, we have about 7 major plates, and the green dot is probably the entire state of Washington. And so we're there. You notice that there's a little blue chip right next to us. That's the Juan de Fuca plate. We're on the North American plate, and then the Pacific plate is offshore into the Pacific Ocean. And those are the major pieces that actually help to shape. Now, there's a smart woman. She brought dinner with her. actually shape what we see in the state of Washington today. So this is a very cartoonish drawing, and part of the reason why I used it, we have what we call a subduction zone and a spreading center. There's really not a whole lot of more information on here. So what sorts of things happen at subduction zones and spreading centers?
Yeah. Also, the subduction zone, when the plates that go on each other, and the other one, is it when they spread apart?
And do you know what kinds of things happen at the surface that we can see there?
Magma rises.
Okay. What happens at that place where we have rising magma?
Volcanoes.
Ocean vents.
Actually, both, they're the long, long volcanoes called the mid-ocean ridges, and the magma rises, and that's where new plate material is formed, is right there at the spreading center. So the youngest rocks on the Earth's surface can always be found at a spreading center edge. Then the subduction zone, the little more difficult to deal with, sort of, at least in my mind. There's obviously a volcano there. Well, you said there was a volcano at the spreading center. Are they the same kind of volcano?
No, the volcano you get here is from the plate being forced down into the heated
friction
center, and so you get friction, you get earthquakes, and then you also get the plate melts again, and so you get pockets of pressure that explode.
Those volcanoes are far more explosive.
Yeah, they tend to have gas and
water mixed in, and those kind of volcanoes are the ones we actually see here on the margin. And we have some very deep earthquakes, and we'll get back to that in a little while. Okay. So this is actually just a map of a very detailed, showing you where the spreading center and the subduction zone are compared to us. We're, of course, just to the right of the little inlet above the N in North, because we're on the far side of the Cascades. So we have this little chip of plate. It's spreading apart, and that's forcing the right-hand plate, the Juan de Fuca plate, up underneath the North American plate. And it's creating what we see today. And this is if we were to actually cut through that and take a good look at it, if we could actually cut open the Earth. We have the Juan de Fuca Ridge and the plate, and then the Olympic Peninsula. And so I wanted to focus next on how the history of the Olympic Peninsula and the Puget Basin, and work my way to the east.
Question.
Yeah,
how many miles is it, say, from the north, you know, from the North American coast to the spreading zone of Juan de Fuca Plate?
You know, I honestly don't know the answer to that. And
well,
it's
I mean, is it 500 miles? Is it 1,000 miles?
Is it
kind of right in between here in Hawaii? Or
it's going to be much closer to the shore than to Hawaii. So, because it's just that little bit of plate piece. Okay, so we have here the Olympic Mountains, and we'd like to know how they actually form. And one of the things that, if you wander out to the Olympics, you'll see are all of these rocks, and they're striped at an angle. Were they deposited that way so that they were actually...
No.
Usually, sedimentary rocks are actually deposited horizontally, and so whenever we see something where the rocks are up on end like that, we know that something rather major has happened, and that was one of the beginning pieces of information that helped tell us when we have folding and faulting. And by the way, plate tectonics is a pretty young theory. It's younger than I am, just, you know, for sort of a reference. It's pretty young. So how did this end up being like this? Well, about 55 million years ago, somewhere in there, for some reason, and it was either a hot spot, like is under Hawaii, where you have a single plume of heated material, it was melting part of the mantle below and creating liquid rock and basalt was coming up, or there was some sort of a beginning of a spreading center, and we ended up with piles of basalt. Now the basalt is a very common thing in eastern Washington. If you traveled in by train and saw the cliffs right outside of Wenatchee, that's all basalt. This basalt would not look quite like that, because it was erupted under the ocean rather than on land. And they cool differently, and so the rocks look different.
The basalt, is that the columnar, faceted?
Right.
Kind of, okay.
Mm-hmm. That's what it looks like when it erupts on land in big sheets. This instead would form what we call pillow basalt, and it forms that way because there's a volume of ocean water and it cools much more rapidly, so it has a very glassy rind, almost like obsidian, a very thin layer of obsidian, and it's called pillow basalt because it forms these big pillowy structures. So that's what we would have had, sediment from the continent and a pile of basalt. Nothing's happening underneath much. The plate's just kind of hanging out. And then about 12 million years ago, that plate began to move. Now, as geologists, we're not really sure why plate motion begins and ends the way it does, so I'm afraid I can't answer why that happened. But as the plate began to move into the continent, it took all of that sediment that was piled up there and squished it up against the land, rather like your rug in front of the door will squish up and form a bunch of folds if you slide it into the door. Okay. And so the basalt is up at the top, the sedimentary rocks are underneath, and the oldest rocks are off slightly to the east, the younger ones are to the west. Okay, and then so what we end up with, if we're looking at a cross section, is an eastern ring of basalt, and then as we go to the west, we have crumpled and folded sediment, and it's been crumpled and pushed enough together that it actually has moved from being sediment into sedimentary rocks, and then just passed into what we call metamorphic rocks. We would call them very low-grade metamorphic rocks, slates, what you'd make a really good pool table out of. OK? pancakes. It splits nicely. And then the just the next grade up, which is phyllite, and that has a nice little sheen to it. If you pick it up, it looks slightly shiny, but not with any big flakes to reflect like that. Okay. And at the same time, the basalt also has been metamorphosed. And so it doesn't look like a typical gray or black rock anymore. Instead, it would be slightly greenish, and we call it a greenstone. And if we were to look at this as a map, now it's maybe a little easier to see where that is. The inner core of rocks are those sedimentary rocks. And then the black line that goes all the way around is the Hurricane Ridge Fault. And then just that little stub at the top is the Kalwa Fault. And so there would be sedimentary rocks at the Pacific Coast. We would move across those, hit the fault, and then we're into the basalt. And there's little patches of basalt in the very eastern edge of the sediment.
Are we looking at an aerial view of?
Yes.
This is a map. This is just the peninsula. Yeah, please, at any time, because I am so used to knowing whether I'm looking at a cross section or a map that I sometimes forget to tell people. And then the last thing, of course, that's happening, and uplift continues. So the plates are still actively crashing into each other. But the most recent thing that's happened has been glaciation. And one of the things that I always, or when I first learned about it, I was sort of surprised, the jagged peaks that I consider to be mountains, to me that's a real mountain. It has to have a jagged, sharp peak. Well, that really only forms because glaciers cut into the mountains. If you just had a tectonic mountain that was formed by squishing and shoving, it would actually be pretty rolling. And in fact, the Andes Mountains at the lower elevations, of the parts of the Andes that aren't high enough to have glaciers on them or have been through glacial cycles, are actually rolling mountains with farmlands on them. But those jagged peaks are actually because the ice has carved and flowed over mountains. So probably your typical mountain, you have to have a glacier to get it.
Yes. So is the pressure from the glaciers enough to cause the rocks to metamorphose?
No, it is not. Even as far as I know, with a really, really thick sheet of ice. And I'm going to come back to some more on metamorphic rocks, and I think that'll help really clarify that when I talk about the North Cascades. It's actually not even a thick enough sheet of ice, even if it were rock, to really do the job. And it's not even as dense as rock, so it's unlikely. So we have now, because of the pushing, we've got the Olympic Mountains, and the next thing we have is the Sound. And the Sound has, like the Olympic Mountains, been constructed a lot by chips and pieces of rock and seafloor being squished in, but it's in a trough rather than being a high, because we have that carpet that has buckles in it. And you have the upper buckle, and then you're going to have a trough before you get to the next buckle. And the Puget Sound is that tectonic buckle down, or the trough, but it's had a little extra help too. A nice aerial view of the Puget Lowland. It's also been heavily glaciated. The lakes that we think of and that inner waterway of the Sound is actually the result of glacial carving. And we see a lot of evidence for that. The bottom left-hand corner is a glacial erratic. We have lots of, used to live in North Dakota, and I like to say it, really what we were living on was little bits of Canada that got shoved down. And we're doing the same thing sort of here, only we've got kind of some of our own rocks at the surface too. So you can see that glacial, stylized glacial lobe that pretty much goes to the bottom of the Sound. That would be about Olympia down there. And the other thing that's very common in the Sound are the deposits of those glaciers, the glacial till that's on the bottom right-hand side. And then the most of the rest of the sound is actually filled in, except for a few places where the patches of real rock come up, the bedrock that has been slammed on, are what we call glacial outwash or marine sediments. And that's what the upper right picture represents. And the difference between the till and the outwash is until you can see you've got chunks of big rock, smaller rock. Ice is not particularly good at sorting by size. It just shoves everything forward like a bulldozer. It's nature's bulldozer. And then water, when it flows across as glaciers melt, or later as rivers flow across the land, will actually start to sort the material by size. And that's how we end up with layered or sorted material. And then in the top picture, actually, that sorted material from the river has gone into a still body of water and settled out to form layer upon layer of marine sediments. So that's a lot of what the sound is made out of. And here is an incredibly complex three-dimensional figure of the Olympics to the center of the sound, so that we have those folded sedimentary rocks and the basalt. And then when we're getting into the center of that block diagram, you'll see that there's glacial till in there, and also the aquifers are sorted material. And this is actually shows everything that you could possibly want. So we have the geology all the way up to the ecology of the clear-cut forest, the dams, and the wetlands where the people actually live up on the top. So this is a cross-section. If we could take a little chunk out of the sound, we would find that underneath our feet we have mostly glacial till and outwash in the sound. Okay, so now we're to the next hump up in the Cascades. We have two sections in the Cascades, the volcanic and the non-volcanic part of the Cascades. And the boundary between them actually is right about I-90. So very conveniently located. I don't know if they planned the highway that way. I doubt it. This is actually a photo of Glacier Peak, and it is a volcano that is in the part of the Cascades that we think of as being dominantly non-volcanic. There's only a couple of volcanoes in the northern half of the Washington Cascades, Glacier Peak, and I always confuse Mount Baker and Mount Adams, but I think it's Baker. You would think after all this time I would know, but I can't tell right from left either, if it's any help. Okay, so, what? I can do north, south, east, and west, but right and left, and I carry them around with me, and it's just embarrassing. So this is actually a map of the volcanic material in the Pacific Northwest, all of the Pacific Northwest. The bright green are the Columbia River basalts, and we'll get back to those later. And then you can see the spine of the Cascades. All the little red triangles are actually the volcanoes that you know, that you would identify. So the first one below Seattle is Mount Rainier, Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams, and then Glacier Peak and Baker above Seattle there. And those volcanoes are actually fairly young. They all formed within the last 2 million years. So geologically speaking, that's really young, because the rocks in this area are pretty much in the 90 to 300 million year range-ish. Okay, so 2 million years, babies, in rock terms. Now, the other thing, because it sometimes gets a little confusing, there's volcanoes, but then we also have in this area a lot of intrusions, or molten rock that actually cooled but beneath our feet, okay, which is a distinction that we make in the Cascades. Although it's all igneous rock, there are eruptive volcanoes pretty much in this upper area. Okay, so let's talk about the volcanoes first. These are a couple pictures of my friend, Mount St. Helens.
Yes.
I grew up in Oregon, and Mount St. Helens erupted in the same year I graduated from high school. I could see the plume on my way to school.
That's why you became a geologist.
No, actually, I didn't do it. But I could, I mean, it was memorable. I could see the plume my senior year on the way to school. And I lived over 60 miles from the Oregon-Washington border. So it seemed pretty spectacular from my point of view. And it, of course, was a fairly violent eruption. And this is just, again, a little refresher. We're on a volcanic front as a part of an arc. And the material that eruptions like Mount St. Helens come from is from that melting of the plate that is going underneath. The reason why they tend to be so violent is there's some of that blue material that's called mélange, which just means it's fractured, broken bits of seafloor and sediment that are scraped off. There's a lot of water that gets down there. Well, rock actually melts around 500 degrees Celsius. And at 500 degrees Celsius, water's a little overheated. just a bit. And so it's under a huge amount of pressure. As it moves upward, the pressure is released pretty rapidly. And, you know, it's sort of like taking a Coke bottle, shaking it up very carefully, and then popping the top off of it. And the gas just pops right out of solution really rapidly. Only instead of having, you know, something nice and liquid like Coke, we're talking about something that is far thicker than honey. And you can imagine honey, gas breaking out of honey would, you know, fling spatters of honey everywhere. And the same thing happens with rock. So this is the east side of Mount Rainier. And Mount Rainier is a somewhat diminished mountain from what it once was. It's been the victim of glaciers. It has a very large number of glaciers for a Cascade volcano. I believe it's the most, which is because partly it's the tallest. That helps. And so it's a lot of it has been carved away, and volcanoes do have somewhat of a normally appointed structure, but the really cragginess that you see, once again, is partly because of the glaciers carving it down. But let's talk a little bit about what happened to Rainier. Now, Rainier used to be about 1,000 feet higher than it is today. And it was higher until about, 100 years ago. And it went through an eruptive cycle that started in 6,600 years ago, and finished with a very, very cataclysmic eruption about 5,700 years ago when it blew its summit off. Okay, so what we see now is what's left. And it gives us an idea of, although Mount St. Helens was a fairly dramatic eruption, from our point of view, in reality, in terms of what the mountains can actually do, it was pretty teeny. In fact, one of the questions I was asked in grad school is, well, how often do you think an eruption the size of Mount St. Helens is likely to come around? And we finally decided that one like that should happen about once every 1,000 years. That's pretty frequent in the terms of geology. And we've since found in a variety of places that there are just huge, huge eruptive centers that we didn't weren't aware that existed until we could actually see things from space and see how large the craters really were. So even this eruption that blasted the top of Mount Rainier off is kind of small.
Oh,
do you have a question?
Yeah. How long has it been since Mount Rainier has erupted?
I think almost all of the Cascades are, they were at about 200 to 300 years ago, a lot of them had erupted. And I believe that that's also true of Mount Rainier. And it's one of those things, what do you mean by erupting? Well, they sometimes go through these really itty bitty eruptive cycles where they just sort of steam and fuss. And so they send up a little steam and they get a little warmer and the glaciers melt a little bit and mud runs down the side and then it goes away. And then there are other times when that's the precursor, as in the case of Mount St. Helens, to a what we would consider a true eruption. So,
Are they all connected? All these volcanoes, are they connected in some way?
They are not connected to each other in terms of, like, the molten rock is individually beneath each different volcano. Mm-hmm. They are connected in that they're all related to those plates crashing together. Mm-hmm. So they have the same cause, but different origins, if that
but
is clear.
They all erupted within the same time space, you said.
The plates.
Kind of.
We're really not sure what causes the interrelationship between plate motion, like does a plate move first? Volcanoes, exactly how the timing of that works out. It, like I said, plate tectonics is a pretty new creature, and it's still got a lot of question marks sitting over it. But if you know the answer, I'm listening. Okay. And so, just as to look at the closest glacier, this gives you an idea of sort of one eruption history in a timeline of one of the Cascades. So we have about 13,000 years ago a pretty major set of eruptions. And so tephra eruptions are when the eruption has a lot of small pieces that are hot but solid in the air. So like you would think of ash plumes or maybe bombs of rocks. Those are tephra eruptions. And then a dome collapse, well, a lot of times the center chunk of lava will actually cool, form a dome, and then that will collapse. Okay. And lahars are very large mud flows. Okay, large enough to reach the sea. Okay, so we're a ways away from the sea. Okay, we are east of Glacier Peak, but we're not that far east of Glacier Peak. So this lahar had like a 3-hour drive to get to the sea. Okay, and
that's a lot,
huge volumes of material
on the coast,
right? I think that finally really came home to me what a volcano was like. Actually, oddly enough, in Bali. I went to Bali. Bali has a lot of volcanoes. And I stopped in a town and said, no, it's okay. I'll just walk because they dropped us. This is where the bus stop is and town's a little ways away. We walked for 5 miles. And at some point, I realized I was walking on the rim of a caldera, rather like Crater Lake. And I had walked for 5 miles, and the view didn't change at all. And there was this island in the middle, and a lake off to the side, and this gigantic ring in the background. So, oh, I get it. Yeah?
So, the mud that went down, is it like hot or just
cool? With a lahar, it is usually cool material. Like, and it usually forms from the melting of a glacier at the surface. And then it mixes in with a lot of the loose material that's very common on the top, on the outside of a volcano because there are ash or there's soil. And it can actually move very large material because it's so thick, it sort of can float large blocks out.
Okay. And is that really fast?
It can be anywhere from slow, like cement, you know, if you've ever watched cement being poured, to like 30 miles an hour. Like, yeah, like bad news. So this gives you an idea of one of the eruptions, and each volcano in the Cascade Chain has its own pattern, and in fact, Mount St. Helens is the most active of all of them in terms of how frequently it erupts. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the area sort of like where we are. If you can see, there's the center, there's the ice and snow that's just off to the right of center. And then you can see sort of the lines in the rock up and down. That's actually metamorphic foliation, where the rocks have been pressed so much that they started to develop a fabric of foliation. And that's very common in the non-volcanic Cascades. And in fact, the rocks in this area show signs of having been buried, and that's metamorphism is always something that happens well beneath our feet, but buried by down to about 90,000 feet. Now, if you stop and remember the last time you were on a plane and you hit cruising altitude, okay, cruising altitude is at 30,000 feet. Now, you know how high above your head the planes have to be that small. Think three times that, but down. And that's an idea of how far down these rocks have been in order to be distorted and changed as much as they are on the surface.
What do you mean by foliation?
How do I explain this? Well, this is what I mean by foliation. Foliation, there are two kinds, and so this rock, if you see how it's banded and striped, that's one kind of foliation, a foliation band where the minerals are lined up separately. And also another, and I don't have this kind of rock, unfortunately, but if you've ever seen a schist, which is made up of little bits of mica, and it will flash and wink at you on one side, and on the other side, it looks like a bunch of pieces of paper on edge that have been put together. That is also foliation. And that's just, it's just where the minerals have either lined up into separate bands, or they have they actually tend to be long, thin minerals, and they actually line up with all those long, thin axes pointing in the same direction. Yeah, that would be the foliage. Thank you, I like that. What? You said like bottom of bottom.
Oh, sure. Is the band of copper, is that an example of foliation? The band of copper in Copper Mountain here?
Copper Mountain, it is in full. I haven't actually, and here's where I have to say, I haven't actually made it to the museum yet, but this area has been metamorphosed, and it is in a gneiss, which does form mineral banding, so it's likely that occupies a band, but copper is not normally found. I mean, not normally part of metamorphosis. Ores are often made when water of variety of origins that has a lot of minerals in it interacts with the rock. And I don't know the details of this particular one. And in all honesty, that is a part of geology I did not study much. So I beg you, go to the museum and look.
How much is the heat down 90,000 feet involved with this process of metamorphizing?
Oh, metamorphism is the result of heat and pressure in different combinations. You can have rocks that have experienced a lot of heat, but not much pressure, like for instance around the magma bodies in a volcano. So the rock that's actually surrounding that, not the magma itself, but the rocks running out. They can have a lot of pressure and not much heat, and that's something that happens in the tectonic boundaries where the plates are slamming together rapidly, but the rocks don't get buried a long distance, or they get buried, but they're on that cold upper plate. And then they can be at high temperature and high pressure, which is actually what happens when they get buried very deeply, as the case here. Okay, so this picture is actually just showing that there really is Mount Baker, that's the volcano here, and then everything in the foreground is all metamorphic rock with its attendant glaciers, which have made it nice and sharp with all those ridges and the glacial lake in the foreground. And usually what happens is the snow and ice builds up, and a glacier will never form if the snow melts each year. So we have to have a net accumulation from year to year, from the winter to the, through the summer, of snow. And actually, one of the things, and I'll talk about it later in the week, is that that is actually, we're losing a lot of the glaciers. And so we have the glacial weight actually carves the rock down, and usually will form a circular, sort of a circular head wall that's called a cirque, and then that pressure will form a run of ice out. Looks, in the case of alpine glaciers, they look pretty much like rivers of ice with a variety of amounts of rock in them. And what they end up leaving behind are arêtes and horns, and in fact, up behind, if we could see through the wall, we would see a really nice arête out, and I don't know what the name is.
Copper Basin.
Copper Basin.
Oh,
so that's
Mark Ridge.
Yeah, the ridge. So
which one?
I was thinking that way, but either way, right. And those are actually what's left after the glaciers have carved both sides, and then between the two mountains out this way, there's a nice U-shaped valley, hanging valley, that's a result also of glaciation in this area. Okay. And so, last but not least, I'd like to talk about the Columbia River Basin and the channeled scablands. The Columbia Basin is almost all flood basalts, and they were erupted really quickly. Now, once again, this is geologic really quickly, so we're talking, maybe 10 million years total for all of those layers, and they actually encompass that huge area that you can see into Idaho, out to the coast. The exact origin of those is a bit unclear, and this is what you would see in this area along the banks of the Columbia River, for example, where you can actually see the basalt jointed in layers, and layer after layer after layer of flow.
Why are they called flood basalts?
They're called flood basalts because they actually came out probably most likely along a long rift, like the upper picture, and what happens is, rather than being a thin ribbon, is they actually flow out in big sheets, and so that they flooded the whole area, so it was a flood of lava instead of a...
And that's a function of how they erupted?
It's actually a function of how hot the magma is and how fluid it is, and then the landscape it comes over, it actually
comes
flows
up,
over.
So whether it has a chance to
flow out. And actually, they are very, very widespread, so it must have been fairly hot. Now, 500-degree rock that I was talking about before is actually pretty stiff and viscous, and it would probably be over 1,000 degrees before you would get really nice fluid rock that would flood out. So, and if you've ever, the bottom picture here is actually a Belknap. And so if you want to know what it looks like after a volcanic eruption, without too much time having passed, Belknap, you can stand on the highway there, and I can't remember which one it is.
Mackenzie,
thank you. And look out and just see.
Is Belknap a city or what is it?
It's just the name of that mountain.
Crater.
The crater. Belknap Crater.
In
Oregon.
Central Oregon.
Yeah, sorry. I grew up there. And so if we actually look at this area, the Columbia River from the air, what we see is it's actually a fairly flat area, especially compared to the western side. And but we see some other things as well. There's the pothole reservoir. There's a lot of rapids. And so that actually, once again, is the fault of a glacier. But this time, instead of alpine glaciers, it's the it's the ice sheet that came down out of Canada. What happened is that little lobe there that's in northern Idaho dammed off the Clark Fork River and formed one heck of a big lake called Glacial Lake Missoula. And, well, you know, what happens if you take a glass and you fill it two-thirds of the way full of ice and you start pouring water in at first?
Jammed at the bottom.
Okay, it just all stays at the bottom. Once you fill that completely full of water, what happens? The ice actually pops up, right? So we have a problem in the making here. We have a dam made out of ice. The ice was about 2,000 feet thick. Okay, so just a little bit of ice. But nowhere near as thick as that 90,000 feet of rock to metamorphose. That was your question. And we know that the ice was this thick, obviously we weren't out there to measure it, this was about 18,000 years ago, because of what we call strand lines. Now all of those horizontal lines across this hill are old lake margins. You know, when the wind blows, the waves flow across go across the lake and will cut a bench. And now the dark green stuff at the bottom, those are trees. So this gives you an idea of how deep that lake might have been at the time, okay? So, and it says actually as a part of the caption, 635 meters, so about 18,000 feet deep. 1800, sorry, I have a hard time with zeros when I'm talking and multiplying in my head. And this is an artist's rendering of what that might have looked like. Yeah, I found this picture. It also would be very cold to be there. Okay, so we have this huge mass of water behind there, and eventually there is enough water, and it does cause that dam to pop up and float. Well, as soon as the dam pops up, of course, the water cheerfully rushes under. And they think that this lake was probably 500 cubic miles of water. That's about the equivalent of one of the Great Lakes today. And if you can imagine somebody pulling the plug on one of the Great Lakes and just sort of letting it flow out, it'd be kind of amazing. And so water probably around 40 miles per hour coming out of the water, 900 feet deep. Yeah.
Where'd the water go?
The water went down from... Let me just, the water, see the channel Scadlands area? That's where the water went.
And down the canyon. Yes.
And then down, and actually flowed back up the Willamette River.
Yes. Right.
Because it just couldn't quite make that bend and head out, because you have the gorge in the way.
And all the gray is where the water went.
All the gray is the flooded area, yes. So, and then what happens? This is, it's a little hard to see, but this is sort of wrinkled looking in the basin. Well, that's ripples. If you go look at a stream bottom or where in a small tide pool where there's little waves, you can see the ripples, okay? Well, this flood did the same thing, only instead of the ripples being a few inches high, they're 15 meters high. You can stand on a mountaintop and look into these valleys and see that the valley floor is rippled. They're just huge, okay? And they may be 200 meters apart. Now, normally, I can, in water that's a few inches deep, I can span the ripples from crest to crest easily with my hand, or maybe a couple of them, or six or seven, depending on how deep the water is. So this is this is how they work out how deep that water had to have been. It's sort of mind-boggling. It was mind-boggling enough that J. Harlan Bretz, who worked this out, a geologist kind of went, yeah, right. sure, if you say so. And one of the things, of course, that happened is with this huge volume of water, it actually had a large amount of power and could easily erode the basalt. So we have floods of really hard rock, and then we have this massive wash of water that comes quite a bit later, and that's how we end up with dry falls.
What's dry falls?
Dry falls is in central Washington in the midst of
not far from here.
Yeah, in the midst of that.
What is that?
The water used to pour over.
Yeah, it's a dry falls now, but it's sort of like if you no longer had Niagara Falls, you would be left with that steep scarp.
Why is the
bowl at the bottom? Yeah. When water goes over the top of a ledge, it goes into free fall and actually starts to dig a hole below.
So it wasn't that big before. So that this material below is softer than the material that was flowing over?
A lot of times that's what causes, yeah. We end up with
this looks like the edge of a flow too.
I sometimes use softer as a very large catch-all.
It probably hit the edge of the basalt and eroded from there.
And this is what actually the surface of the basalt will look like with channels cut into it by the flowing water as pieces of the basalt. Remember, the basalt has that fracture pattern, and so all it takes is to actually catch one of those pieces and pluck it out to start building a channel. As soon as you have a lip face like that, then a lot of times it will eat back as the water flows over it.
So how long would it have taken for that lake to empty itself?
It actually didn't do it in one thing, because it required the floating of the ice.
Yeah. So once it emptied some, the ice would settle?
Would settle down, yeah. So that's actually pretty common. Right now in the Juneau ice field, up near Juneau, they're waiting, at least last week, they were waiting for one to happen. Mm-hmm. And they actually can sense that in that case by keeping track of the temperature in the river below. And as soon as the temperature drops, they know that they've got ice-cold water coming from behind the ice dam. And usually it will pop up just long enough. There's a small window of time that pops up. And a lot of glacial floods are actually on the order of weeks to months. And then they're done. Pretty fast. And then the lower area in the foreground would be a large bar like you would see, a gravel bar like you would see along a river, only its size comes from the water pouring out from behind that ice dam. And so that's my little really broad, quick explanation of the geology of this area. Thank you so much. And if you would like to know more, and you're a hiker and you're in the Washington area, I would recommend that you might want to take a look at Scott Babcock and Bob Carson. Scott Babcock's at Western Washington. Bob Carson's at Whitman. They wrote this book called Hiking Washington's Geology. And so they tell you where to go to look for different things in this area if you're interested.
They have it in the store.
And they do have it at the bookstore. Okay.